So at this time, I'd like to call Brother Harold forward to speak to us on this topic of Obadiah.
Well, thank you, Brother Mike. And good evening, brethren and sisters, and young people. Tonight we want to look at this little prophecy of Obadiah. And we want to try and find out what relevance it has to our own salvation. And that's the object. And as we read through this chapter tonight, you notice we had the word Obadiah only found in the first verse, only once. Of course, it's only one chapter, but that's about all we know about Obadiah, is his name. And looking around at our little ones around the ecclesia these days, I don't believe there's anyone called Obadiah yet. And that could be a good name for anybody that's planning on a name for a child. It means servant of the Lord. It's a good name. Or worshiper of the Lord. Now in the Old Testament you'll find about 12 people called Obadiah. But because we are not told the name of this particular prophet's father, we don't know who he was. We're left in the dark as to who he really was. Also, when did he write? We don't know, because there's no reference to a king that reigned when he was prophesying. Quite often you'll get that. You'll get Jeremiah reigned in the time of so-and-so and so-and-so. And then we can determine when the prophet wrote because of that, but we don't know when he wrote, because there's no king mentioned. We do know that he was probably a prophet sent to the southern kingdom, because as you probably remember, we read about Jerusalem and Mount Zion in this chapter. But primarily, Obadiah is a prophecy about Edom. Now, Edom, to jog your memory, is to the south of Judah, between the Dead Sea and the Red Sea. Now, commentators on Obadiah have made a variety of dates possible for this writing. Some of them say it was 853 B.C., and then other ones say it was 586 B.C. or even later. But it doesn't matter which one was, really, because Obadiah, as we read through it, he could have been looking ahead to the attitude that Edom would have towards Israel or to Judah's troubles. And he could have been referring to past events as well. So it doesn't matter. The underlying theme of this short prophecy is that Edom was very happy when Israel was in trouble, when they were being attacked by enemies. In fact, Edom participated when those enemies were troubling Israel. And the Edomites, they considered themselves a very strong and secure little nation. They lived in the hill country of Edom, the rocky terrain, and they looked upon Israel with quite a degree of smugness, hostile smugness, those Jews. You no doubt remember Esau. Esau was the twin brother of Jacob. And Jacob, he had 12 sons. Esau had 11, and they developed into the nation of Edom. Now, there are several words in the Bible, all of which refer ourselves to that nation of Edom. And on this first overhead, I'd like you just to notice the variety of names that are used. And in three different prophecies, Genesis chapter 36 and verse 8, thus dwelt Esau in Mount Seir. So the Seir was the mountain terrain in Edom that they lived in. And often you just get the name Seir, and you know that it's talking about Edom. Esau is Edom. So those three words. And then Isaiah chapter 34 and verse 5, for my sword shall be bathed in heaven. Behold, it shall come down upon Idumea and upon the people of my curse to judgment. Idumea. So God wasn't happy with them, and he was going to curse them and judge them. So that's another word for Edom. Ezekiel 35, verse 3, and say unto it, thus saith the Lord God, behold, O Mount Seir, I am against thee, and I will stretch out mine hand against thee, and I will make thee most desolate. So God didn't like Edom, and he was going to judge them severely. And that's the topic of the prophecy of Obadiah. God was not pleased with Edom personally, with Esau personally, and the nation that developed out of Esau. Esau's offspring seemed to demonstrate the same sort of hostility towards Israel. Therefore, the entire nation seemed to be justly deserving the condemnation of God. Now we have another overhead showing the location of this nation of Edom. BPT, well, just for the record, B is Bozra, P is Petra, and T is Teman. You get these names. And again, they sort of tell you it's talking about the nation of Edom. Now this red part on the map is Edom as it was around 600 BC. And then there's a little dark area to the north of that, alongside of the map of the Dead Sea on the south end. And that's the revised approximate boundaries of Edom as it was during the Babylonian and Greek periods. So from north to south, it's about 100 miles long, and east to west, it's about 60 miles wide. So in the foreknowledge of God, it seems that the descendants of Esau would not be God-fearing for the most part, and many of God's prophets outlined the doom of Edom. Isaiah 34, written in the 700s B.C., speaks of, in verse 6, of a great slaughter of Edom. In Edom, stretching out the plumb line of desolation. These are words that are not pleasant. So what had Edom done? What had they done that deserved the punishment of being completely obliterated as a nation in the earth? Well, Psalm 137, verse 7 tells us very clearly what they had done. Psalm 137, 7. Remember, O Lord, what the Edomites did on the day that Jerusalem fell. Now, when was that? Well, that was in 586 BC when the Babylonians destroyed the city of Jerusalem. And what did the Edomites do? They cried out, tear it down. Tear it down to its foundations, says the psalmist. Amos 1, verse 11. Edom pursued Israel with the sword. Ezekiel 25, verse 12 says Edom took vengeance against Israel. And Obadiah 10, as we have read, accuses Edom of doing violence against thy brother. Of course, they were cousins, weren't they? Can you imagine having a cousin like Edom? That wouldn't be very pleasant. Now, some 800 years earlier, prior to the Babylonian time, when Israel had just left Egypt and had been wandering through the wilderness for 40 years, and they were finally leaving the wilderness, and they were on their way to the promised land. And they wanted to pass through Edom. And they said, we'd like to pass through Edom, please. And what did Edom say? You may not pass through. There's no way. And then they brought their army out, and they said, there's no way you're going to pass through our country. So did the cousins fight the cousins? No. Israel backed off and went south. And they went all the way down here along the northern end of the Red Sea and went around to the Promised Land that way, just to avoid conflict with Edom around near the Gulf of Aqaba there. Well, there are three major events in the history of Edom that gradually developed to their demise. Their absolute end was happened in three basic steps. Now, contrary to popular belief, the Edomites are not Arabs. They're cousins of the Jews, but they're not Arabs. In fact, the Nabataeans, who were a nomadic people from Arabia, pushed the Edomites out of their territory. And where did they go? Well, they went north. And that's why we have this dark area here. That's where they settled, in the southern part of Judah. But the Nabataeans from Arabia pushed them out. And this happened during the time when Judah was not there. They'd been taken into captivity by the Babylonians for the most part. And Nebuchadnezzar, as you remember, was active during the years. He took Daniel into captivity and Ezekiel into captivity. And that happened from about 605 to 597 BC. And that's when the Edomites moved in to the south part of Judah, because the Jewish people weren't there for the most part. The Edomites occupied the city of Hebron, and then they said, well, that's our capital city, and they became known as Idumeans. Why? Why would they change their name? Well, they didn't really. They didn't change their name. They were still Edomites. And it was the Greeks. The Greeks decided that Idumea was the word that described the Edomites. And it means pertaining to Edom. So when you see Idumea, it just simply means Edom. You see, both words, Edom and Idumea, in the Hebrew text, they're the same Hebrew word. Same spelling in the Hebrew. So the Authorized Version translators seem to have been influenced by the way the Greeks said Edom, or the way they rendered the word. Even though they were translating Hebrew, they said, well, here's Idumea. But the original language is the same word. Now, that's one event, the Nabataeans. The second major event that happened to the Edomites was during the days of the diminished Greek Empire, when the Edomites were subdued by the Maccabees. The Jewish leader Hyrcanus, during the years 125 BC to 109 BC, was having a lot of trouble with the Edomites, the Idumeans to the south of Judah, and finally had to put his foot down. And as a nation, they were attacked by the Maccabees and subdued. And then they were given three choices. You Edomites, you can die if you want. And that didn't seem to please many of them. They were given the opportunity to leave the country. They didn't want to do that, because they got used to it. They'd been there since the 500s, and now it was the 100. They'd been there for several hundred years. They liked it there. So what was the other choice? They had to be circumcised if they wanted to continue living in this country that they decided to call home. Now, Josephus, so that's Idumea in the time of the Maccabees. Now, Josephus has a few words to say about that particular incident with the Maccabees. The Edomites, what did happen to them? We find the answer to that in the Antiquities of the Jews by the ancient Jewish historian Josephus, writing of Jewish conquests in the 2nd century B.C. So he's looking back a couple of centuries and says this is what happens, what happened. Hyrcanus took also Dora and Marissa, cities of Idumea, and subdued all the Idumeans and permitted them to stay in that country if they would circumcise their genitals and make use of the laws of the Jews. And they were so desirous of living in the country of their forefathers that they submitted to the use of circumcision and the rest of the Jewish ways of living. So they adopted the Mosaic law, at which time, therefore, this befell them, that they were hereafter no other than Jews. So the Edomites were displaced, as we've seen, into that area. The Edomites were then absorbed as proselytes into the Jewish community. So two events so far. Third event. The third major event, which forever obliterated any trace of the name Edomite or Idumean, was in AD 70. In AD 70, the Romans were on the scene, and they either killed or enslaved all the inhabitants of Judea, whether Jew or proselyte. They killed them or took them into slavery, and from that point forward, the Edomite was no more to be found as a separate and distinct people. And that's in agreement with Obadiah. Obadiah, we should actually look at Obadiah, I guess. Verse 18, where it says, there will be no survivors from the house of Esau. That's another translation. But the King James Version says, there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau. And that was in AD 70. So with that background, let's tackle a few verses in Obadiah. Now, this doesn't mean we're going to leave the history out. Now we're going to take that history and try to fit it in to this one chapter of Obadiah. Now, the first 14 verses of Obadiah foretells the total destruction in the land of Edom because of Edom's refusal to help Israel. That's why it's happening to them. And then verses 15 to 21, the latter part, describes Israel's restoration, Edom's doom, and it also brings us into the 21st century. And that's peculiar, isn't it? We've said Edom has been obliterated. Why would we have Edom in the 21st century? Well, we'll try to explain that as we go. So let's read the first four verses, keeping in mind what we mentioned about Edom's history. The vision of Obadiah. Thus saith the Lord God concerning Edom, we have heard a rumor from the Lord, and an ambassador is sent among the heathen. Arise ye, and let us rise up against her in battle. Behold, I have made thee small among the heathen. Thou art greatly despised. The pride of thine heart hath deceived thee, thou that dwellest in the clefts of the rock, whose habitation is high, that saith in his heart, who shall bring me down to the ground? Though thou exalt thyself as the eagle, and though thou set thy nest among the stars, thence will I bring thee down, saith the Lord. So we can see that Edom felt like a very secure people, dwelling in the clefts of the rocks. They would have been a nation very difficult to get down. you know, little holes in the face of the rock, and without a few rocket-propelled grenades, you couldn't get those folks out of there. And those hadn't been invented yet. So they were very secure. Nevertheless, there was an ambassador to be sent by God, verse 1 of this chapter, to bring pain and sorrow upon Edom. So obviously God intended to make one of their enemies successful in getting them out of there. Now in verse 7, we have a rather interesting verse which is actually talking about the Babylonians and also the allies of Edom, all at the same time. All the men, verse 7, of thy confederacy have brought thee even to the border, the men that were at peace with thee, so there's the allies, and have deceived thee. The men that were at peace with thee have deceived thee and prevailed against thee, and they that eat thy bread have laid a wound unto thee, there is none understanding in him. A rather difficult verse, but from this verse we can see that there's acts of treachery being foretold. And there's a list of allies of Edom found in Jeremiah 27 and verse 3, and they include Moab and Ammon and Tyre and Zidon. And all of these nations that I just mentioned were defeated by the ambassador of verse 1, and that was Nebuchadnezzar. However, somehow, although there was treachery between these different nations, and no doubt Edom was just as treacherous as any of them as well, Edom somehow managed to remain in their own territory long enough to rejoice over the distress that Nebuchadnezzar was inflicting upon Jerusalem. So let's just read about that again in Obadiah chapter, well, he's the only chapter there, but verses 10 to 14. And think about Edom being involved with what Nebuchadnezzar is doing to Jerusalem. For thy violence against thy brother Jacob, shame shall cover thee, and thou shalt be cut off forever. In the day that thou stoodest on the other side, in the day that the strangers carried away captives his forces and foreigners entered into his gates and cast lots upon Jerusalem, even thou wast as one of them. But thou shouldest not have looked on the day of thy brother in the day that he became a stranger. Neither shouldest thou have rejoiced over the children of Judah in the day of their destruction. Neither shouldest thou have spoken proudly in the day of distress. Thou shouldest not have entered into the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Yea, thou shouldest not have looked on their affliction in the day of their calamity, nor have laid hands on their substance in the day of their calamity. They were looting Jerusalem. Neither shouldest thou have stood in the crossway to cut off those of his that did escape. Neither shouldest thou have delivered up those of his that did remain in the day of distress. They were even handing Jews over to the Babylonians, it would appear. Not very nice. So they were allies of Nebuchadnezzar, helping in the sacking of Jerusalem. However, shortly after that, as we've mentioned already, Shortly after 586 B.C. and the destruction of Jerusalem, the Nabataeans from Arabia successfully drove the Edomites out of their holes in the rocks of Edom. And there they were, in the south part of Judah. Not too many Jews around, but 50 years later, in 536 B.C., the Jews came back from Babylon. The exiles returned, just as Jeremiah said it would happen. 70 years, Jeremiah said, but it was 70 years from the very beginning of the invasion by Nebuchadnezzar in 606. 606 to 536, 70 years. And there was Edomites ready to, well, they were an unwelcoming committee, you might say, in southern Judah to these returning Jews. But they managed to survive, the two factions managed to survive until the Maccabees came on the scene, as we've said, in 125 BC, and that's when they became Jewish proselytes, or die or leave the country. They had these choices. So they most of them became proselytes. And they may have become good Jewish citizens, not unlike Quebec, being part of the Canadian community today. We see them, of course, they managed to retain their special status, didn't they? The Quebec people do that. The Edomites seem to retain their special status in the community of the Jews. In fact, they married Jewish women, and there was intermarriage. And some of the Idumeans became leaders in the Jewish community. And you can remember one, can't you? Any of the young people remember one Idumean that became a leader in the Jewish community? Yes.
Herod.
Very good. King Herod. He was an Idumean, and not a very nice one. He was possibly typical, but an Idumean who was very anxious to retain his position as King Herod. And when Jesus Christ was born, he heard that he was going to become the king of the Jews, so this Idumean had all the two-year-olds and under killed to help him retain his position as King Herod. Well, this Idumean faction in the Jewish community was still there, as we said, in AD 66 to 70 when Jerusalem was under siege by the Romans, and the Roman armies were surrounding Jerusalem, and inside the walls of the city of Jerusalem, instead of the Jews concentrating on the enemy that was coming down upon them, they were fighting themselves. Amongst themselves, there were 20,000 Idumeans plus other Jewish factions within the walls of the city of Jerusalem, all very busy fighting amongst themselves. And the end result, of course, was the Romans destroyed the city of Jerusalem, and the inhabitants were either killed or put into slavery. And that, again, is the end of the Edomites, the Idumeans, and any trace of Edom. I guess we don't need that on. Well, this brings us to Obadiah, verses 15 to 21. When we read our Bibles, we find the word Edom quite often, Esau quite often, Edomites. In fact, these words are used as types in the Bible to describe the enemies of Israel in the last days. And that's why we say that the latter part of Obadiah is dealing with our century. We're aware that in the last days, we are told in the prophets that there will be a northern confederacy of nations who will invade Israel and defeat Israel, and they will occupy Israel. And we also know that this confederacy of nations will not only do all of those things, but they'll also die in Israel. Let's have a look at three little verses just to give you that little bit of background. Daniel chapter 11 and verse 45. Now, this is a confederacy of nations called the Northern Invader, and the last verse of Daniel 11. And he shall plant the tabernacle of his palace between the seas. That is the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean Sea. This is the occupying camp, if you like, of the northern invader between the seas in the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end and none shall help him. He's only going to be there a little while, occupying Israel. Now back up to Ezekiel chapter 38 and verse 9. Again, it's speaking of the northern invader coming down. Verse 9, thou shalt ascend and come like a storm. Thou shalt be like a cloud to cover the land, thou and all thy bands and many people with thee. That's exactly what Daniel was saying. And then look at verse 39, chapter 39 of Ezekiel and verse 4. Thou shalt fall upon the mountains of Israel. So he comes to the end, doesn't he? This invader comes to his end. Thou shalt fall upon the mountains of Israel, thou and all thy bands, and the people that is with thee. I will give thee unto the ravenous birds, etc. So this northern confederacy of nations will attack Israel, but will fall upon the mountains of Israel. Now, how does that fact fit with Obadiah? Let's have a look at Obadiah, verses 15 and 16. And we see a similarity. For the day of the Lord is near upon all the heathen. The heathen are the ones that come down upon Israel. As thou hast done, it shall be done unto thee. Thy reward shall return upon thine own head. For as ye have drunk upon my holy mountain, so shall all the heathen drink continually. Yea, they shall drink, and they shall swallow down, and they shall be as though they had not been. So in this verses 15 and 16, the prophet is making a comparison between Edom that came to its final demise in Israel at the hands of the Romans when Jerusalem was sacked. He's making a comparison with Edom's fate and the fate of the heathen or the nations that come down upon the mountains of Israel and attack Israel and then die on those mountains. So they're the latter-day Edomites. Edom died in Jerusalem. The latter-day Edomites, the heathen are the nations who come against Israel. They shall be as though they had not been. So when we're doing our daily readings and we come across a word like Edom or Esau, you should ask yourself the question. There's all kinds of examples. We don't have time to look at them all. But you should ask yourself the question, is this prophecy about the last days where Edom is just a word to be used to describe anti-Semitic nations who want to drive Israel into the sea? Is that what we're reading here when we're doing our readings? In fact, some Old Testament prophecies use the word Edom when referring to nations who will be in opposition to Jesus Christ himself and the glorified saints. And one example of that is in Isaiah. Let's just have a look at Isaiah 63. And it's a little conversation going on in this chapter. Isaiah 63, verses 1 to 6. Who is this that cometh from Edom with dyed garments from Bozrah? That is glorious in his apparel, traveling in the greatness of his strength. Now this is Israel asking the question, the inhabitants of Israel. And Jesus Christ, through the prophet, is responding, I that speak in righteousness, mighty to save. That's who's responding, Christ. Wherefore art thou red in thine apparel, and thy garments like him that treadeth in the wine fat? A question by the Israelites. And verse 3, I have trodden the winepress, says Christ, alone. And of the people there was none with me, for I will tread them in mine anger and trample them in my fury, and their blood shall be sprinkled upon my garments, and I will stain all my raiment. For the day of vengeance is in mine heart, and the year of my redeemed is come. And I looked, and there was none to help, and I wondered that there was none to uphold. Therefore mine own arm brought salvation unto me, and my fury it upheld me. And I will tread down the people in mine anger, and make them drink in my fury. Make them drunk in my fury, and I will bring down their strength to the earth. So Israel is asking the question, and Christ is answering the question, who is this that cometh from Eden? He's the one who is mighty to save, who will save Israel from this latter-day Edomic enemy. Jesus Christ will, of course, tread down those who oppose his righteous rule. And it'll be both a military treading down and a religious treading down. There'll be two aspects, militarily and religiously. He will first subdue the nations that have occupied the land of Israel, as we read in Daniel chapter 11, verse 45, and Ezekiel 39, verse 4. And secondly, he will have to subdue the papal opposition, described in the latter day as the latter day fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7. The latter day fourth beast of Daniel 7 will be centered in Europe, and Christ and the saints will have to subdue that part of the latter day Edom as well. The King James translators in Isaiah 63 put a heading which says this, Christ's power to save. The translators knew what this chapter was talking about. And the subheading is victory over his enemies. This is a messianic chapter. And when we take the time and we find Jesus Christ in the prophets, then we know that we're on the right track towards salvation. Look at what 1 Peter says. 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 10 and 11. Of which salvation the prophets have inquired and searched diligently, who prophesied of the grace that should come unto you, searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ which was in them did signify, when it testified beforehand the sufferings of Christ and the glory that should follow. What about this glory? What is the glory that should follow? Christ must subdue opposition, but glory will follow. Let's go back to Obadiah, because that's the book we're supposed to be doing tonight. Obadiah, verse 17 and 18. Let's read those two verses. But upon Mount Zion shall be deliverance, and there shall be holiness. And the house of Jacob shall possess their possessions. And the house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau for stubble. And they shall kindle in them and devour them, and there shall not be any remaining of the house of Esau, for the Lord hath spoken it. And verse 21, and saviors, the last verse, shall come up on Mount Zion to judge the Mount of Esau. That's a strange way of saying things, isn't it? That they'll come to Mount Zion to judge the Mount of Esau. Well, it's obviously a latter-day Esau, those who have occupied Jerusalem, and the kingdom shall be the Lord's. So in verse 17, then, in Obadiah, when will there be deliverance? When will there be deliverance on Mount Zion? It's when Jesus Christ and the glorified saints arrive at the Mount of Olives, splitting it in two, and saving the Jews from this occupying force that we've read about in Daniel 11, verse 45. And in Obadiah here, we get a few details of how the Jews that will be residing in Israel today, those that are left, those that survive the invasion from the north, how they will be used by Christ and the saints to expel the latter-day Edom out of Israel. Obadiah verse 18 speaks of Jacob and Joseph on fire for God. the remaining people that are there will be on fire for God, reducing the latter-day Edom to stubble. That's what the verse says. The last verse of this chapter talks about saviors, plural. Saviors, plural, who arrive with Christ to administer this judgment upon the Mount of Esau in Jerusalem. And that's the northern invader, isn't it? These saviors, Christ and the saints, mobilize the surviving Jewish population in verse 18, cleansing the land of Israel of the heathen invaders. And what currently is a very tiny nation, if you look at the map, it's a very tiny nation, Israel, is soon to become expanded. And Obadiah explains that as well. It's going to be expanded. Look at verses 19 and 20. There's a lot of words there, a lot of names. But you cut them down and you find that Mount of Esau used to be to the south of Israel. So Israel's borders are going to move south. The plains of the Philistines, well, that's to the west. It's going to move west. Fields of Ephraim and Samaria, they're going to move north. And Gilead, east. So the tiny nation will become much bigger. In Obadiah, verse 21, there's a contrast made between the Mount Zion and Mount Esau. And we know when the latter day Esau, or Mount Esau, is finally destroyed, the result will be the 144,000 on Mount Zion, Revelation 14, verse 1, which symbolically is saying the kingdom of God is beginning when Christ occupies Jerusalem. This mountain, in verse 21, is a symbol that is also found in Daniel chapter 2 and verses 34 and 35. I'd like you to turn to that. And I am watching the time. The Daniel 2, verses 34 and 35, where in the language of the vision, it is telling us who it is that makes up the latter-day Mount Esau or Edom. This latter-day composite power of anti-Semitic nations that we could read about in Ezekiel 38 is described as an image made up of four metals, gold, silver, brass, and iron. Nations who will soon invade Israel. But this victory is short-lived, as we said, as they will be defeated by the stone that becomes a great mountain. And we know the story very well, but we'll read it again. Verses 34 and 35 of Daniel chapter 2. Thou sawest, till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote this image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, and the brass, and the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floor, and the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain, and filled the whole earth. Now I want you to try to imagine what Daniel saw, because I think Daniel had this same vision that Nebuchadnezzar had. And both of them saw a very large stone. I happen to have a stone here, and I have someone's going to catch it over there. And they saw this stone flying through the air. And it landed upon the feet of the image, and it broke it to pieces. The Christ stone will become what Obadiah describes as Mount Zion, the symbolical mountain that refers to the kingdom of God. And Daniel and Obadiah are right in tune with each other. But you know, before Jesus Christ, the stone, can knock down the image, that image has to stand upright. And the latter-day Edom image, well, it's identical to the latter-day fourth beast, which will not be standing up until it has possession of the whole earth. We're in Daniel. Let's just have a look at Daniel chapter 7 and verse 23. Now, here we have a description of the latter-day fourth beast. And I've got a picture here of the stone that just flew through the air. There it is, hitting the feet of the image. But you notice that verse 23 of Daniel 7 says this. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon the earth, which shall be diverse from all nations, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down, and break it in pieces. The fourth beast. Now we say, well, the fourth beast was Rome. The nation, the empire of Rome. But the empire of Rome never controlled the whole earth of Daniel's visions. The whole earth of Daniel's visions went all the way over to India, and the Romans were just in the Mediterranean area. So this verse in Daniel chapter 7 and verse 23 involves all of the land masses that are in Daniel's prophecies, right from Spain to India. Therefore, this latter-day fourth beast is being mentioned here because Daniel asks about it. He wanted to know about this latter-day fourth beast. And he was explained that the latter-day fourth beast must control the whole earth. And you can see from these maps on the overhead that was much bigger than what the Roman Empire used to own. So what part of the whole earth is yet to be controlled by the latter-day Edom? Well, there are a number of places in the earth that are yet to come under his control. The northern invader nations are coming together. We can see it in the news every day. But they're not all quite together yet. All the way from Spain to India, that's the latter-day Confederacy of Nations. And that they're listed for us in Ezekiel 38. There's one final piece of this jigsaw puzzle that has to be put in place before the stone can strike the image. And that last piece is the nation of Israel. Until the northern invader controls the nation of Israel, then the image cannot be knocked down. So when Israel is invaded, and when Israel is occupied by the fourth beast of Daniel 7 and verse 23, which is the latter-day Edom of Obadiah, which is also the northern confederacy of nations of Ezekiel 38, then we'll know that it finally controls the whole earth from Spain to India. And it is then that the image will finally stand up and be ready to be ground to powder by Jesus Christ. Now, we won't be there to see that. We'll be taken to the judgment seat before this happens. But we can see it developing today. We can see these nations coming together as a confederacy, and we know that the final piece of the jigsaw puzzle will be Israel. And we'll see it when we're with Christ at the place of judgment. Well, tonight we've seen this is conclusion. We've seen the historical demise of Edom. We've considered this prophecy outlining the demise of latter-day Edom, the standing image of Daniel 2 and the latter-day beast of Daniel 7. So we might now have a little bit of idea of what must happen. And we know it will happen because God has a plan, and it will happen. Now the question is, are we personally ready? Are we ready for it to happen? Individually, are we ready for these things to come to pass? And the other question we could ask is, have we managed to push Esau and Edom out of our lives? And are we allowing Jesus Christ to come in to fill the void? We have to do that. We must do that if we want to be part of those saviors that are mentioned in the last verse of Obadiah. Obadiah verse 21 talks about saviors. If we really want it to happen, we can be part of that which is described in Obadiah. We can be part of those saviors of Israel with Christ. And we can also be part of the bottom line. There is a bottom line in Obadiah, and it says we can be part of a kingdom which shall be the Lord's. Thank you.